advice and Mr. Grant's, I've been taking lessons in reading and elocution. Martin states that he derived great advantage from the lessons. To his cousin, he writes, Mr. Seedsel has been taking great pains with me. My insipid, inanimate manner in the pulpit, he says, is intolerable. Sir, he said, it is cupola painting, not miniature. That must be the character of the man that harangues a multitude. Preaching would never be Martin's strength, though there are a few references to problems in elocution as he developed as a preacher in India. But Martin's primary purpose in London was not to improve his elocution, however necessary that may have been. Martin was uniquely suited for translation work, and the need for linguistic preparation in Asian languages, especially what was then referred to as Hindustani, was paramount. For Martin and his backers, it was essential that he begin work with John Gilchrist, the Scottish linguist, to lay a strong foundation in Hindustani. Gilchrist was the author of a dictionary and grammar of Hindustani, as well as the inventor of the term itself. He had taught at Fort William College in Calcutta, but had recently returned to Britain to recover his health. Martin began study of the dictionary prior to their lessons, and though he studied diligently, in the event, Martin concluded his time with Gilchrist had been of only limited value. After less than a year in India, Martin wrote to David Brown asking for a native pundit, I find Gilchrist's Hindustani is too fine to be understood by any but the servants of the English. Adding that a Hindu may probably be able to teach me something of the language of the villages. Martin's unyielding commitment to mastering the language as it was spoken by the poor, as well as by the elite, assisted him greatly in producing a translation of the highest quality. It was a translation which was, in the words of Daniel Corey, admired as a composition, no less than as containing important truth. A final set of tasks remained for Martin before departure to India. A set of legal and bureaucratic hurdles. He was obliged to get a mandamus for a Bachelor of Divinity, which by university statutes he must obtain within 6 years or lose his fellowship. Martin reported his progress to his friend Hinsman. The petition of the mandate was signed by all the heads of the houses and passed to the Senate in 2 congregations, and is now with the Chancellor, who must get the mandamus signed by the King. Then it must be passed on to another congregation before I can have the degree. I called on the Duke this morning, and I'm not certain which Duke he was he called upon, but he was not at home, and thus my time is wasted by my running to and fro after these great people, Mr. Grant, Mr. Wilberforce, etc., who are so overwhelmed with business that there's no seeing them alone. Martin subsequently met in May 1805 with the Archbishop of Canterbury at Lambeth Palace, a standard procedure for new East India Company chaplains. Martin reported he was very civil and wished me all the success I could desire. With these hurdles overcome, he was sworn in as an EIC chaplain a few days later. Yet despite the best planning of the great and good for the speedy, untroubled departure of their remarkable young chaplain, the unexpected happened. Martin fell in love. Lydia Grinfell was the sister of a cousin on his father's side, and there was a notable disparity in age. In 1805, Martin was 24 and Lydia 30. Despite the 6-year difference, Henry's interest appears to have been reciprocated in some measure by Lydia. Unfortunately, she felt herself obligated by a commitment to a previous suitor, an obstacle her overtender conscience had difficulty resolving. More problematic, her mother viewed the prospect of her daughter's marriage to an evangelical chaplain living in the distant East Indies as thoroughly undesirable. The year leading up to his final departure was marked by great turmoil as he wrestled with his feelings for Aunt Lydia. Within a week of seeing the Archbishop of Canterbury, we find him in Cornwall with Lydia, called after tea on Miss Lydia Grinfeld and walked with her, conversing on spiritual subjects. All the rest of the evening and at night, I could not keep her out of my mind. I felt too plainly that I loved her passionately. The direct opposition of this to my devotedness to God in the missionary way excited no small tumult in my mind. Simeon was adamantly against marriage at this time, believing it would distract Martin from his focus. But the view was not universally shared. Martin recounts, on the Monday at the eclectic meeting, Mr. Cecil, speaking of celibacy, said I was acting like a madman in going out without a wife. So thought all the other 10 or 11 ministers present, and Mr. Foster among the rest, who's unmarried. This opinion, coming deliberately from so many experienced ministers, threw me into great perplexity. Martin wrote to Simeon detailing the arguments in favor of marriage in his case. Simeon's answer was what might have expected from the lifelong bachelor. Martin explained to his cousin Emma, his answer decided my mind. He put it in this way, is it necessary? To this I could answer, no. Then is it expedient? He then produced so many weighty reasons against its expediency that I was soon satisfied in my mind. My turbulent will was not, however, so easily pacified. I was again obliged to undergo the severest pain in making that sacrifice which had cost me so dear before. Better had it been if those wounds had never been torn open. I say to Lydia, and with her to all earthly schemes of happiness, farewell. Yet the young lover was not so easily satisfied. Only a month later, just weeks before his departure for India, Martin reports, I arrived at Marazion in time for breakfast and met my beloved Lydia. In the course of the morning, I walked with her, though not uninterruptedly. With much confusion, I declared my affection for her with the intention of learning whether, if ever I saw it right in India to be married, she would come out. Her response was noncommittal. Martin's emotional turmoil over his departure, particularly from India, intensified. And a month before his departure, his biographer, Sergeant, states that he fainted and fell into a convulsion fit, at an inn while en route to Portsmouth for what he thought to be his final departure. Simeon was there at the port to see him off, as was his fellow future chaplain, Daniel Corey. A delay due to the threat of French ships forced a stop in Falmouth and allowed for a final meeting with Lydia in Cornwall in August 10th, 1805. It was at her house that he received the final summons to board. All my painful presentiments were thus realized, and it came upon me like a thunderbolt. Lydia was evidently painfully affected by it. She came out that we might be alone at taking leave, and I then told her that if it should appear to be God's will that I should be married, she must not be offended at receiving a letter from me. In the great hurry, she discovered more of her mind than she intended. And she made no objection whatever to coming out. Martin sailed later that day in the Union, an East India Company vessel, as much of a much larger East India Company fleet, with the escort under the command of Sir Homerigs Popham. The support of Martin's friends didn't end at the dock. Simeon in particular remained Martin's chief supporter and agent in Britain, a role he played for many of the other chaplains he'd recruited to Indian service. One example was his earnest, though ultimately unsuccessful, suit to marry Lydia Grenfell, a suit which he renewed with great earnestness once he had established himself in India. The suit ultimately collapsed due to Lydia's mother's strong objections. Simeon himself went to Cornwall to press Martin's suit, apparently overcoming all obstacles but her mother's opposition, which he concluded was insurmountable. In the event, neither Henry nor Lydia ever married. In the final months of Martin's life, as his extreme frailty became evident on his homeward journey through Persia and Turkey, Simeon arranged with Grant to send emergency funding in an unsuccessful attempt to provide for Martin's safe journey homeward for recuperation. The money never reached Martin. Martin's early support team would become, not surprisingly, his chief mourners following his death. Wilberforce deemed excellent Martin's death a mysterious providence. Simeon informed Grant of Martin's passing, lamenting, what a loss which India and the world has sustained. The death profoundly affected Simeon. His biographer Karras reports that Simeon hung a portrait of Martin, this portrait, over his fireplace, the effect of which he explained to his friends. No one looks at me as he does. He never takes his eyes off me. And seems always to be saying, be serious, be in earnest, don't trifle. Simeon's reaction to reading a copied version of Martin's journal expressed what many in the Christian public later felt. Truly, it has humbled us all in the dust. Since the apostolic age, I certainly think that nothing has ever exceeded the wisdom and piety of our departed brother. And I conceive that no book except the Bible will be found to excel this. The inexhaustible richness of his ideas gives to his relations an interest superior to anything I have ever read. John Sargent, encouraged by Simeon and others, set out to memorialize his friend in his now famous biography. The dedication and self-abnegation evidenced in the journals and struggles they documented caught the imagination of many in the Christian public and led to Martin being revered as an Anglican missionary hero. Almost 70 years after his death, the Church Quarterly Review termed him the first great missionary of the English Church since Boniface. The journals, along with the translation and apologetic works Martin left behind, provided a lasting testament to his labors. There is something of this lively, passionate man that continues to move us with its force 200 years on. Martin remains an inspiration as an individual. But it is important to see in his story a reminder that great enterprises, whether sacred or secular, are not merely the result of one individual's vision. The work of a dedicated team of supporters, as well as the faculty and students of this college and university, had first shaped Henry Martin for his future work, and then ensured that the impact of that work was preserved and endured for us to reflect upon today. In Henry Martin's life, we're able to witness how the aspirations of a devoted and gifted genius converged with the deeply felt commitment of others to produce a life's work worthy of joyful remembrance.
Well, thank you very much indeed. That was a fascinating account. We've got sort of 20, 25 minutes to question Scott or raise some issues. So the floor is open.
Yes, I heard it said that he was somewhat critical of British attitudes in India. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, you see it in the comments to the East India Company,
yes.
Which some Buchanan, for example, was not at all uncomfortable with the East India Company and Governor Wellesley's activities. But Martin showed a greater sensitivity to the role of the English there. There were comments he made to generals, serving officers. Say, when one of them criticized Napoleon, he made a comment, well, who knows whether you might have done the same in his situation. There were constant and comments about whether England would be spared by God because of its own injustice. So there was a sense that England's place in the world was not always the right one. And he was not an apologist for England, unlike many of his period who served in missions. I found this one of the unique points of Mark Martin. He had an independent mind in this respect.
Thank you.
Other questions? I'm sure there are plenty. If not, I'll dive in. Sorry, after you go.
I've forgotten the name, the school friend and patron who preceded him.
Kempthorne,
yes. Just wondered what became of him afterwards. He's obviously a sort of religiously serious person. Was he part of the evangelical movement?
Yeah, he was. Quite conservative. He went on, I've forgotten the name of the church he pastored, but he spent a career in ministry. He published a small work of psalms, comments on the psalms, and was involved tangentially with several of the mission activities. There is a letter, though, that he donated a small sum of money on Henry Martin's death as a bequest, sort of a tribute to Martin, I would say. It was only £5, but I don't think he was a well-off man. So he remembered the friendship of their youth, even in his older age. But that's all I know of him myself.
Oh, well, I'll check my question. I asked sort of over lunch a little bit. It seemed to me interesting and ironic that within the evangelical movement there's this quite strong hagiographic kind of thread, which has always struck me as slightly curious. And the sort of question I was going to ask is, I wonder to what degree you think the Romantic movement kind of has an impact upon the kind of evangelicals at this period in time. I remember back in 2007 when we were looking at the bicentenary of the abolition of the slave trade, there was a number of books on abolitionism and the role of evangelicals. And this was one of the things that kind of emerged in one of those books, looking at people like Clarkson and Wilberforce in the way that they represented themselves and their moral task was you know, some sort of overlap with some of the ideas coming out of the Romantic movement. It's just a
I honestly have not given a great deal of thought to that. I've often thought of Martin in ways that are similar to Keats, the young poet's death and the romantic innate notion attached to the death of a young hero like this. And I think that was part of the romance of Martin in the period. But I haven't ever thoughtfully connected into the movement as a whole, and I wouldn't want to just throw something out without giving it adequate thought.
I wondered, but I've got a question on preaching. Just interested, do you have any sense of what was expected of an evangelical preacher there? I mean, the word harangue, which came out of your quotation, suggested that there was a particular style.
I didn't know if that only pertained to his preaching in the UK, or whether that was part of the vision of what he would be doing in India, that there would somehow be masses of people. But I think the harangue of the was not uncommon. The evangelical sermons were quite long, and they were to sustain a long sermon. There has to be a great deal of energy, and I think this was very much a part of sermons at that period, and even some sermons today, if they're of that length. If you go to a 45-minute sermon, you're going to want to have a certain amount of energy and activity. But also, I think you have to consider there were no microphones. We were in an era of microphones, and when you go to a chapel service and we hear a wonderful sermon, it's broadcast with wonderful speakers. But here, just as with Wesley and Whitfield, when they would preach to 6 or 10,000 in the field, I mean, the necessity to project your voice to reach a crowd in a large church or in an open area, I think also is part of what he's referring to. And I don't think Martin was known for his projection of sound.
At the back there?
I'd just like to ask a bit more about the Bible translations that you mentioned, translation into Urdu, and I think you said into Arabic as well.
Yes.
I was wondering specifically, was it building on early attempts to do that? I know that there was an 18th century attempt by the SPCK to make an Arabic Bible. And then the second question is, was there much of an afterlife of these translations? Were they important in the history of translation of the scriptures into this? Yes.
The Arabic translation, there were several at the period. There was one that was used primarily by the Christian population in the Middle East at the time. And it was, Martin did not think it was an adequate translation, and he didn't think it was a translation that a Muslim could read. It was very focused on language and culture of the Christian community, and it had become quite dated at the time. There were several efforts going on sporadically, but no one had made a systematic effort at that point for, goodness, about 100 years. So he set out to do the work with Sabat, his chief language assistant. Sabat actually did some good work, but when Martin died, that work was in a rather primitive state. There were efforts to shape it and refine it, but eventually it was just deemed impossible, and the effort had to be begun again entirely. So his Arabic translation work did not survive in any real form. The Urdu translation, or Hindustani, survived wonderfully. It was a magnificent translation and was highly valued. In fact, even modern translations of the Bible in Urdu still look back and use it in much the same way that a modern translation in English would look back to the King James for comparative reasons, for linguistic reasons, stylistic, because it was so foundational in creating the language and the phrasings and the expectations of what the Bible would contain. The Old Testament work, which he hadn't completed, which was in rough draft form, was actually seen to be so good, even in the rough draft form, that it only required minor revision to be published for the Old Testament, and some books needed to be added. The Persian translation has been improved upon, but it was, I understand the Pope put it on the list of banned books in the first year after it was published. But it was published using the Bible Society's office and printing press in Russia, and a copy was given to the Shah of Persia. It was presented by a British ambassador. Its utility, it wasn't used in a widespread way, but it still affects and shapes the modern translation, and was the foundation for much of the modern New Testament translation, even today.
Scott, I would first of all thank you for that great lecture. Thank you for that. But I wanted to ask you, beyond the translation work, what do you think is the abiding legacy of Henry Martyn?
I think it comes in a couple forms. One, people learn and are shaped by people often as their individual story, just as I was talking about remembrance. And I know a lot of my own shaping in life has come biographically. You learn what's possible because you see others have achieved things and done things. And so Martyn has always been a great encouragement to the church, sort of a galvanizer for great deeds. And I think that's the way he's most often seen. But I think an undeveloped area of Martyn's influence that I would like to see developed more was the shaping of the discussion between Islam and Christianity. The essays and the debate between the Muslim scholars and Martyn were translated and published in England, and they were used by missionaries, Protestant missionaries, as the basis for a series of debates that occurred during the first half of the 19th century between Muslim scholars and Christian scholars in India. Avril Powell has talked a great deal about this. She's a scholar at King's College and in her work. And this, I think, is even of more significance than just the historic, because what it did is it shaped the way we view and argue and discuss with each other. And so when today we have discussions that are ongoing between the country that I live in, UAE, and also in Qatar, and the Church of England, religious discussions go on, and they tend to rest on theological issues. And these theological issues are the same issues that were framed back by Martyn's arguments. And I often felt that this could be approached more fruitfully in a historic manner, and talking about how our perceptions of each other were shaped. How did we decide who each other were? Because Islam changed their own argumentation and self-presentation, I think, in some ways, to meet the Christian critiques. And Christians changed their own apologetic structures to meet Islamic critiques. And I think there is importance in unpacking that historically, if we're going to create a genuine discussion between Christianity and Islam today.
Interesting.